This is WJCT News 89.9 in Jacksonville. Opinions expressed on the First Coast Week in Review are those of our panelists and do not necessarily reflect the views of WJCT News 89.9.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and you're listening to First Coast Connect. It's Friday, so that means it's time for our First Coast Week in Review. Our panel of local news hounds helps us break down the week's headlines, and among today's topics, officers involved in police shootings can no longer remain anonymous. A sex scandal embroils the head of the Florida GOP and the founder of Moms for Liberty. City leaders pay a high price for a liquor store nobody wanted. A drug dealer faces manslaughter charges after his customer overdoses. And a judge refuses to drop the criminal charges against the original prosecutor in the Ahmaud Arbery case. Also later, songwriting school with Rickolas. It's a full show, so let's get to it. Joining me in the studio, Hethel Bahat, former BBC journalist and producer at two local news stations. Welcome. Attorney and former Jacksonville City Council member, Randy DeFour.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Joining us for the first time, my former colleague, Renata DiGregorio, reporter at First Coast News.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Andrew Pantazzi, investigative reporter and founder of The Tributary.
Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. You can listen live on the radio or you can watch our video stream right now on Facebook and the WJCT YouTube page. But don't just watch, join our conversation. Do you think officers involved in police shootings should be publicly identified? Do you believe they qualify as crime victims? Give us a call at 549-2937. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Message us on Facebook or Instagram, or tag us on X at FCC On Air. All right. It's a case with major ramifications for law enforcement and crime victims. The Supreme Court of Florida ruled Thursday that Marcy's Law can't be used to conceal the identities of police officers who use deadly force. The Jacksonville Sheriff's Office and agencies around the state have argued that officers involved in fatal shootings qualify as victims under Marcy's Law, which is supposed to protect victims of crime. Andrew Pantazzi, this is an issue you are deeply familiar with and have written about at length. Remind us how we got to this point.
So in 2018, Florida has a commission that every 20 years proposes constitutional amendments for the state constitution. One of those amendments in 2018 was Marcy's Law, this new protections that was going into the state constitution to protect the victims of crime. And there were a number of people who were concerned about what the ramifications of the expansive protections would be, which included potentially limiting the information that criminal defendants could get, and also potentially doing what it ended up doing in some cases, where limiting information about police officers who shot civilians. And in fact, in this case out of Tallahassee, the police union fought to have officers' names removed and made confidential if they shot someone because they could assert that they were the victim of a crime by the person who they were shooting. And until now, the lower courts had allowed that to go forward. And so places like the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, which had previously released the names of police officers who shot people, had stopped releasing those names. Now, the Florida Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, has said, in fact, Marcy's Law, which provides protections against victims from being harassed, that does not mean that you are not allowed to release names. And in fact, you are required to release the names under public records law in most cases. So the Florida Supreme Court soundly rejected every basis for this argument that police officers or anyone else, that you can't know the name of someone who is alleging a crime has occurred. And I think that also goes to some of the founding principles of our country and the U.S. Constitution, the idea of the right to face your accuser, that knowing the name does not mean that you are capable of harassing a person. It's not like releasing the home address of, you know, police officers. But if they are accusing someone of committing a crime against them and saying that they shot themselves after a crime occurred, then you need to have the same kind of right of confrontation. And so that was part of the basis. And the other part was the idea of public records. Florida has long had robust public records law, with the idea being that we need to know what is happening in government, and we need to be able to educate and inform the citizenry to be engaged in the process.
Randy DeFour, how surprising is it that this conservative Florida Supreme Court unanimously voted against this bill protecting police officer identities?
I don't think it's that surprising. It's the right ruling. If you look at the circuit court ruling, I thought they really got it right. It was the first DCA that overturned it. And what they ruled was that the public had a vital right to evaluate the conduct of law enforcement. I mean, law enforcement, they're public employees, and they work for us, right? So I believe that Supreme Court got it right, that they should be held accountable and transparent.
Renata, there have been growing demands for police transparency, especially the last few years. And the way that law enforcement interpreted this law seemed contrary to that request and that demand.
Yeah, I know over in Tallahassee, they were saying that the officers had to be the victims because of how it was done with when it happened, like Andrew just said, with the two Tallahassee police officers who had shot and killed people. But I also know that in the attorney who was representing some of the Tallahassee people, they said that it was in an earlier court argument, so it wasn't quite this part, but that the police officers weren't technically acting as individuals for this. They were acting as the government. I believe he said that they were the government when they were doing this. So it kind of took away the part of them having that individual right to be protected from privacy. But there has been a really big growing demand. I mean, if you talk to anyone around here, that's one of the first things they say is police transparency is really what they want and what they want to see. So I know they see this as a win, I believe.
So we actually interviewed Tom Hackney. He's a former director at JSO and a longtime, you know, law enforcement officer, about this issue. Talking about the protections that Marcy's Law provided. Let's hear a little bit about what he had to say, because it really goes to what you're talking about, Renata. Is a police officer, quote, like a person, or are they an agent of the government?
Having dealt with a few dead law enforcement officers who have been killed in the line of duty, they looked like dead people to me. Having been involved in a shooting, I felt like a person. And I think it's easy to assign that. You know, you're not a person as the outsider until you're involved in one of those incidents. You certainly feel like you're being victimized at that point in time. I can close my eyes right now and remember the .357 that was fired my way. I felt pretty much like a person that day. Lucky to go home. And again, I think the protections that are afforded by any law should apply to a police officer in the performance of their duty, just like it would to any other person out there.
Hethel, what of that? I mean, obviously officers, you know, who are in at risk, you know, sometimes in very dangerous situations, feeling that they are victims, that they should be regarded and protected under this law.
And it is important to note that in the case in Tallahassee, both of the police officers in those cases, there was no wrongdoing found against either of them. And so the Police Benevolent Association said, you know, we need to do a better job of protecting these officers. On the other side, transparency is the biggest issue in law enforcement right now. And another thing that we need to note is not only are we going to now see the names of these police officers involved in these shootings, but the videos that have not been released, those will come out now, because those were also being protected by this assertion that Marcy's Law protects their identity. And what have we seen? We know that those videos in a lot of cases are the only reason that we have accountability in law enforcement. So I certainly understand the fear that police officers have. It's a very hard job, what they do in law enforcement. They put their lives at risk every day going out there. But I think that this was the right ruling. And I think that what's going to be interesting to see is what kind of comes of it also in terms of just the general public. Everyone's names can now be released and how that's going to be put out. I will also say, when this was first proposed, the League of Women's Voters said that this was going to be an issue. How are we going to? The language was not clear. There was too much gray area in terms of how this could be used. And I think we're seeing that now. The court is giving some clarification on exactly how it should be used.
I know, Andrew, when this was, you know, pending before the voters, all the attorneys that, you know, we ever spoke to were talking about what a disaster it was going to be. It was just going to create a hornet's nest of issues. But you have some kind of new news on this issue. tell us about the transparency website. What happened after this law was passed and what's happening now?
So the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, which publishes a database of police shootings, has updated it. I had checked yesterday. They still had not updated it immediately. But as of this morning when I checked, they've updated it to now include the names of the police officers who have shot people.
And so after this, the lower courts had interpreted that officers were victims under Marcy's Law. JSO went and scrubbed the entire site of officer names. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. And this is very important for the public. Something that I know and, you know, we've both reported on before is like there are certain police officers. There's one sergeant in particular who has had repeated police shootings, and being able to know if there's one person who is having all of these shootings that can allow for scrutiny to say, is there a reason behind this? Is there something that maybe deserves a second look? And once those names went away, outside of sourcing, you could never know if there's one police officer who's responsible for most of the shootings, or if it's, you know, each person, or, you know, having more details about the specific names. They did release ages, they did release some information, but they weren't releasing names. And so there were particularly problematic police officers. That's not something you could have known.
So we've got a call, Mark from Mandarin. You're on First Coast Connect. Good morning, Mark. Go ahead.
Good morning. Something I want to speak to is that I work in public safety, and when I'm talking to my coworkers or new recruits, I try to remind them that as soon as you put on that uniform and you're working for the public, your expectation of privacy really needs to be checked. We work out in the public, and we must have the trust of the public. Everything we do should be open-faced and forward-facing to the public. And that extends everything from their social media sites, that now that can be scrutinized because it can misrepresent or somehow harm the reputation of the city or the agency that they're serving. And what I also remind our recruits is that as public safeties, as many, Florida has a law that allows public safety persons, uniform officers, judges, social workers, to allow their personal information to be redacted from property appraiser, the tax collector sites, office of circuit courts. Because right now, most people can go online and they can find that dissolution of marriage, or they can find a property tax record. They can see where somebody lives and get all of these addresses and information. Under Florida law, that can be redacted, but the individual police officer, uniform officer, must opt in and contact that county from which they serve and fill out those forms. And that is something that I encourage all of our employees to do if they're concerned about maintaining some sense of privacy, to avoid otherwise people trying to come after them or harass them.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate your thoughts. Hethel, what of that? I mean, there are protections in place already for some judges, from some law enforcement officers, but you do have to opt in.
Yeah, and I think that he made a very important point, which is that if you are fearful of your life, and that's a safety is an important issue for you, and you have one of those jobs, that you should do that. You know, a lot of people in media, sometimes we have to also be afraid of people stalking us, or, you know, I understand the fear there. At the same time, I do think the transparency aspect is important. You were talking about if we don't know the name of the officer, think about the George Floyd case, Derek Chauvin. If we didn't know his track record, that played such an important role in that trial. If we didn't have his name, we wouldn't know that. We wouldn't know the history, and we wouldn't have the context. So I do think it's important. And I also think that, you know, we need to really think about, as a society, what are we doing with law enforcement that we're having so many of these cases too? That's the bigger picture I think we should be looking at, is how many cases of use of force that we're having. And I'm glad that we had that gentleman talking to their young recruits. I hope they're doing good training so that we don't have these situations so much in our community.
I want to take one more call on this. We've got AJ from Mad Dads. Good morning, AJ. Go ahead.
Yes, I want to know, will the names of all the murder victims that haven't been identified in our city, will those names also be released to the public? There's so many families out there that haven't had justice because we can't identify the victims in these cases.
Thank you, AJ. And that's a great question we were talking about early. Andrew, they've very often police have trouble solving cases because they're not allowed to widely put out there, this is who was killed. Hard to get tips from people who may have seen that person that day or know that person if nobody knows who the dead person is.
Yeah. And in fact, when this was on the ballot in 2018, at the same time this was on the ballot, I believe it was North Dakota, police chiefs and sheriffs across the state were trying to overturn identical language from their own constitution because they said it had made it so difficult to solve crimes. Because if there was a burglary at a pizza restaurant, it was interpreted as, hey, the pizza restaurant is a victim. So you can't say the name of the restaurant. You can't say the location of the restaurant. You have to say there was a burglary somewhere in the city involving a food establishment. And will you please help us solve this crime? Unsurprisingly, it became much harder to solve crimes. Similarly here, to the caller's point, the victim's name's not being released. When you're trying to say, we're trying to find out who killed, oh, well, actually, we can't tell you who, but it's a 68-year-old white female who lives in the city somewhere, or lives in this general vicinity, lives in the, you know, west side. That becomes a lot harder than being able to give the specifics of here is the person, here is a photo of the victim. We are trying to solve this crime. As of right now on the transparency website, they have not updated the homicide database that they have to include victims' names. It's still coming up as exempt.
All right. We're going to move on now. Breaking news yesterday, the Sarasota Police Department is investigating Florida Republican Party Chair Christian Ziegler. He's married to Bridget Ziegler, a school board member in Sarasota County and Moms for Liberty co-founder. This story is sending some reverberations around Florida and the country. Randy DeFore, what is your take on the political implications of this and the significance of it?
Well, especially for the Moms for Liberty. I mean, that's an organization that has pointed their finger at a lot of different sectors of our community, saying that they're bad or not acceptable. And so it tells you that, you know, there may have been a finger pointed towards individuals, and there were three pointing back at her. I mean, it's just so disappointing. I mean, I'm a Republican. It's beyond. I think he should remove himself as the head of the GOP, and I think she should remove herself from Moms for Liberty. Let's hope she, I'd like to see the book she banned too.
Yeah, so Hethel, Moms for Liberty certainly has been a bit of a lightning rod, calling for, you know, book bans, worried about sexual indoctrination, a lot of issues of gender identity. So certainly at the center of that conversation.
Yeah, she was definitely a big supporter of the Don't Say Gay bill, right? And then you have these allegations that this couple was having a threesome, and now there's rape allegations against her husband. Obviously, they are innocent until proven guilty. Their attorney says there's no doubt that they're going to prove that they're innocent in this case. But it was interesting to see the governor's response. He very quickly, upon hearing about this, said, we don't know if they're guilty or not, but he should step down. And, you know, we can't have this in our party. So it's a really critical time for the Republican Party in the state of Florida. And the last thing they need is a scandal like this. So it's definitely going to be interesting to see what happens.
Andrew, what is your take on the governor's decision to make that request? He did yesterday say that this, you know, the chair should step down, Christian Ziegler. But it's still very loosely, the accusation, the police report's fully redacted. It's been reported, but it's to sources, anonymous sources, that this has all happened. So how firm of a ground is that to call for someone to step down as the head of the GOP in Florida?
I mean, I think it's probably because of some of the governor's presidential ambitions and the fact that Christian and Bridget Ziegler have been very much the key allies pushing forward on the culture war issues, things like the Don't Say Gay parental rights and education bill, pushing on this theory that the governor and his allies have put forward that there are predators in school that are targeting children by giving them inappropriate materials to read and leading to the banning of books from school libraries. And having the person who is at the center of that accused, rightly or wrongly, I can understand why the governor is quick to say, you know, I want to quash this narrative before it gets any further. The governor did say, you know, still he gave the qualification of, you know, innocent until proven guilty. But I think it shows how much the governor is under pressure. And also, frankly, the fact that the governor decided to run for president and is at the center of the ire of President Trump, where now he is much more subject to the type of harsh attacks that historically they've been more unified as a party. And now he's actually experiencing those attacks. And so he's probably trying to get away from any future options for the former president to be able to attack him and say, look at who you have in your vicinity.
We want you to join the conversation. Give us a call at 549-2937. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Message us through the Facebook and Instagram pages, or you can tag us on X at FCC on air. Renata, you've done a lot of reporting on just the issue of book bans, the number of book bans that have been coming, particularly out of Florida. Surprising, maybe not surprising, but it is the center of a lot of this debate. And Moms for Liberty obviously has been a very big part of pushing that agenda.
Yeah, Moms for Liberty is really, I mean, I don't think many people had heard about them a couple of years ago. And then suddenly we hear about them when it comes to politics. And we have people who are running for the school board who are part of the organization. And it has become such a front and center thing with the book banning just across the nation, too. But Moms for Liberty has really been really big for that, running it in that way as well. And so we hear on one side from a lot of people who are saying, you know, politics shouldn't get involved in where there's school, but then it just increasingly is. And we're seeing that so much more. And so it should be interesting to see kind of where things go from here on out now as things continue with now that they're kind of integrated, where we have politics and Moms for Liberty and school and books and education. It's all really synonymous now.
And I wonder, Randy DeFore, if you think it could affect the upcoming school board races in any way, just the fact that there are candidates that have, you know, are aligned with Moms for Liberty.
You know what? I don't think so. I don't think this will have any impact on the elections. I think there's been a tremendous amount of pressure on several of our school board members who are great members but have not followed the masking rules, and so there are it's going to be interesting. I've been watching that very closely, and there's a lot of money being put behind some of these candidates that are with Moms for Liberty. So I don't think it will have any impact.
Andrew, your thoughts about the political impacts of it, if any?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I think Randy's right. It remains to be seen if there's any actual political impacts. It's hard to tell. Honestly, a lot of what's hard to tell right now in politics in Florida is how much of 2022 was a new reality for Florida, where there was very firmly established Republican-heavy, conservative-heavy results. But also in 2022, despite those Republican-heavy results, because school board elections happen in August, the school board elections were much more progressive than the November elections. It's a weird, you know, turnout drives a lot of it. The Democratic Party has pushed really strongly to make sure they don't have competitive primaries in August, so that will probably depress Democratic turnout by trying to clear the field for the Senate race. So that probably will have. I think more of what will impact the results in school board races is the fact that Democrats have pushed to not have competitive primaries. And so there will be less Democrats voting in those school board races than otherwise.
We've got a call, Lisa from Tallahassee. Welcome to First Coast Connect, Lisa.
Good morning. There's just so much to unpack here. The hypocrisy and the corruption, this is kind of not a bug. It's a feature. I mean, the sponsor of the bill, Joe Harding, you know, was convicted for felony for fraud, taking $150,000 in COVID money.
You're talking about is known as the Don't Say Gay bill. That's what the parental rights bill.
Exactly. Okay. I'm sorry. and then, you know, the Jefferson School District controversy with, you know, it involves Manny Diaz and Jacob Bolivia and Corcoran, who's now getting this you know, exorbitant overpayment for heading up new school. I mean, education, you know, the problem with a lot of this is DeSantis has controlled the media in Florida with this iron fist. And a lot of these stories are not making it out there. And the Department of Education crisis and Jefferson was being pursued, you know, legally, but then squashed. But now it's, I believe the feds are taking it on because of what happened with the charter school stuff. So, you know, education is one of the links that the Republicans are using to you know, gain power in Florida, but they're doing it in a way that hurts our kids and affects people's ability to be able to trust even worse, you know, in our government.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. We're going to move on now. We have a $2 million zoning mistake to discuss. So this week, the Jacksonville City Council voted to buy a controversial liquor store after a Northside community complained about its proximity to homes and a school. This is the Brentwood community. Renata, why was the community protesting the liquor store and its location?
Well, it's actually, if you have gone by Golf Fair, the exit on I-95, or if you've gone your COVID shot even over in the Gateway, that's where they had tons of COVID shots over in that parking lot area with a big tent. It's right there across from the school that you pass. It's a Kip Vocal Academy, I believe is what it's called. And so it's they're saying it's right across the street from the school. This is what we don't need right here. We'd rather have something that, you know, could be basically anything else is what they're saying. And it's also a predominantly Black community. And so they're saying, why are we putting this right here also, causing this even bigger issue is what they're bringing up.
And so the city has agreed to pay, I believe, about $2 million for this property, Randy DeFore. Talk about that. This maybe even dates somewhat back to your tenure on council.
It does. I was on council when this, just to remind everybody, what happened was this was determined to be allowed as an exception for alcohol by the Planning Commission. It never made it to the city council. And it's interesting. I think, the applicant had a lobbyist, I believe it was Paul Hardin, so that should have told you that they knew that was going to be some challenges because the planning department had opposed it because they knew Kip was going to be there. It hadn't been built yet, but Kip was coming. And because of that, legislation was passed that said no more can the Planning Commission make those decisions, that those decisions now have to be made at the city council level. But my question would be, you know, my understanding is they've done an appraisal, and the appraisal was $1.8 million. I mean, it just seems so high given the size of the building. I'm wondering if there needs to be a second opinion, if you will, as to the value. But, you know, you've got an owner. He built the building. He doesn't have to sell. So I'm sure they're probably paying a little more than it's worth.
And we should clarify, the agent that you're talking about that represented in the original application is a lobbyist and a kind of well-known, powerful lobbyist. So
very powerful.
Hethel, talk about the community here. This is not the only project that they've got concerns about in the area. There's also a planned medical examiner's office.
Right. And one of the things that you were talking about, the value of the building, $150,000 is what this was bought for, right? And now we're talking about $1.8 million. The city's saying, you know, if we were trying to do something with eminent domain to obtain things, we would waste this money in legal fights. But I think, you know, these communities, they need more resources. They need grocery stores. They need we have food deserts in Jacksonville. So, you know, they don't need another liquor store. And the medical examiner's office was also something that they'd talked about, but this shouldn't come as a surprise. People were protesting this, and I think the big issue is why are we not listening to our people in the city that are showing up to these city council meetings? To Randy's point, they have now since passed a rule that says it has to come before the committee, that so there won't be a loophole like this where something can get passed through it. But talk about a $1 million mistake. I mean, that's huge. And I think the other thing is, you know, the Northside Coalition came out and said, well, this is a win no matter what it costs, because at least we're doing the right thing. But the right thing is coming at a huge price tag.
Yeah. And I'm sure the community is gratified that they've won the victory, that it's not going to be a liquor store. But it must be kind of galling that an area that is already so economically deprived is seeing this level of investment for something that they're not going to really see any direct benefit from.
Yeah, and this is the result of the former planning commission. It was a key thing on the campaign trail during the mayoral race. One of the things that Donna Deegan had spoken about a lot was her plan. Specifically, she would call out the planning commission as one of the commissions she wanted to diversify to have more racial and gender diversity.
What was its makeup previously?
I'm not sure what it was previously, but I do know that that's one of the areas that she had targeted, and she did remove previous planning commission members. The previous planning commission had been appointed by former Mayor Lenny Curry that had approved this. There have been a lot of complaints for a long time now. It's been close to 30 years since the city passed a neighborhood bill of rights that was never given any teeth and never truly enacted so that neighborhoods could have a say in the planning process. And I think that's, you know, even more than should this go to city council, I think there needs to be a question of how do we empower neighborhoods themselves and empower CPACs, which are citizen planning advisory committees that neighborhoods are a part of. How do we empower the neighborhoods to have more of a voice and a say in this process when it comes to these types of zoning decisions?
We've got a caller, Stanley, on the north side. Good morning, Stanley. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, everybody, especially Mr. Ford there, because I got plenty of love for her, and I'm a Democrat. My main point here is that this has been going on for years, just over 30 years. I've been on the charter revision, and when it comes to ethics, for 30 years, nobody said anything about ethics. And it continues in this city here. For the city to take that money from a community that needs the money and not put it where it needs to be is a tragedy. No matter what the Northside Coalition, we've been fighting this for many years. And I'm the person that's been fighting it because I'm on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Stanley. We appreciate that. So do we know what's going to happen to this building now?
Well, they do have plans to hopefully make it a community center. That's what Jacoby Pittman has said she would like. Hopefully they find something that's going to serve the community, whether it's tutoring for children, some type of area that people can come after school. But yeah, it's a $1 million community center is what we know right now.
All right. Well, we're going to move on now to the story of an arrest that was announced earlier this week.
Graham's arrest on manslaughter charge evidences how seriously local law enforcement treats overdose deaths. Those who profit off the pain of those in our community struggling with addiction will be held accountable. One overdose death in our community is one death too many. These deaths are preventable, and we will continue to aggressively pursue those who supply these lethal poisons to vulnerable members of our community. And let me tell you, if you're selling drugs, selling opioids and fentanyl in our community, now's the time to stop. Because we're coming, we're going to keep coming.
That's Sheriff T.K. Waters, Jacksonville Sheriff T.K. Waters, Tuesday announcing multiple charges against a 44-year-old alleged drug dealer. Following an accidental overdose in July, police began a long-term investigation into the man suspected of selling this unnamed victim the drugs. Renata, you've covered this issue previously, but it is always unusual when you have someone who's being arrested for a murder or a manslaughter charge that, you know, was afar when that death occurred.
Yeah, and I know this is something that we're seeing not just in Florida, but in multiple states where they're basically, in a way, kind of broadening the definition of what a dealer is. So it's technically, I know there's the case in Oklahoma where there was the two friends, one of them overdosed and the other one got charged for his death. And it is important to note there, I did want to say this, I was thinking while we were kind of reading up on this, that Florida does have a law where if you can't get in trouble if you're helping someone get medical assistance who is overdosing. So I feel like that's just good to put out there just as we have that for anyone.
If I could just correct that law only applies to drug charges, not to manslaughter. So fact, the first case we had years ago was they arrested the people who called 911 when two young teenagers, 18, 19, were doing drugs with one of their girlfriends, and the girlfriend overdosed. They called 911 for medical assistance, and they charged those young men with manslaughter. They couldn't charge them with drug charges because the Good Samaritan law doesn't allow you to be charged with drug charges, but it does not mean that they can't be creative and say, we're going to charge you with manslaughter or murder.
Andrew, you've done a lot of reporting on the issue of, you know, adjacent crimes being prosecuted, like a felony murder. Talk a little bit about the complications and some of the concerns that come with those prosecutions.
Yeah. So felony murder is when you are committing some sort of felony crime and then somebody dies, regardless of whether you had anything to do with that. The common example people will use is if police shoot and kill someone and you are committing a burglary with that person, they may charge you with murder because you committing a burglary with your friend and then the friend getting killed by police, they're going to pin the killing of your friend on you, regardless if you were armed or not. What has changed recently when it comes to these drug overdoses is they have changed the law to make it easier to prove. Before, you had to prove that they were a proximate cause of the death, would mean you have to be able to show that the drugs that this person gave to this other person was actually what caused the death. And sometimes there's many reasons why someone is dying. They're using more than one type of drug that they got from more than one person. And so they've now made it much easier by reducing the standard on just that it was a significant factor contributing to the death to make it easier. And those can be all the way from manslaughter up to first degree murder with death penalty charges involved. And in fact, that same first case I was talking about, the guy who actually sold the drugs in that case, who was not there present, did not call 911. The state death certified the case, indicated they were going to seek the death penalty at the time. That drug that was not included in the law, and so they ended up having to drop the charges. But the state attorney's office was indicating they were going to seek the death penalty back then. Former Sheriff Mike Williams at the time announced this policy of every single drug death in the city, we are going to treat as a murder and we're going to investigate as a murder and dedicate our murder investigation resources to these drug deaths. The idea being that if we are harsh enough, maybe that will lead people to be less likely to sell. I've talked to a lot of experts. I've reached out to a lot of people and I've tried to find any experts who agree with that. I've not yet found one who has said that being that harsh, increasing the level of punishment is going to affect people who are usually themselves addicted to drugs and selling to pay off their own habits. Instead, usually they say it's more about frequency and the reliability of punishment as opposed to the length. Seeking life and death sentences for these crimes, they've said there's no study that finds that that is a reliable way to reduce drug overdoses and that Florida is not experiencing a decline due to that.
Randy DeVore, as an attorney, what is your take on the broadening of this interpretation of somebody providing drugs that had a contributing factor possibly to someone's death?
Well, I think the intent is they're trying to get to the supply chain, right? So it's interesting. I did some research on this for preparing for today, and I didn't realize this law actually went back to 1982. And then it was, to what Andrew said, was expanded in 2017 to include fentanyl and other drugs. So this has been in place for a long time, and there are 20 states that have the similar type of drug-induced homicide laws. But the real issue, as we all know, is addiction. And I think if we've got to start, and putting addicted people in jail does not work. We really need to change our mindset and start working with the gateways who are full, you know, expanding those services to our community. And I think we're going to get a lot of better results from that than using this law.
Hethel, your thoughts? There's a push to try to move away from penalties and to try to broaden the opportunities for people to seek and obtain treatment. But right now, there isn't a great opportunity for people who want to get treatment for drug addiction.
It's not affordable. There's not space. People go for treatment. They get clean. They come back out and they're addicted again. And I think that's what we need to talk about. Why are people overdosing? Because this fentanyl is highly addictive. Much more addictive than heroin. So people are overdosing because they can't get enough of the drug to get the high. And then they keep doing it. It's an illness. It's a sickness that they're dealing with. And to punish those people I don't think is the right way as a community. It's really a lot of what we do, which is, you know, try to say, hey, we're going to do a little something here that's not really treating the broader problem, because it is an octopus. There are so many different parts of, when you think about why do people get addicted to opioids, it's a lot of times someone gets in a car crash and they had legally a prescription that helped them with pain, and then they got addicted and now they can't get out of it. So, you know, it's not how we used to look at other drug epidemics in this country, whether it's crack cocaine, or this is a very different epidemic and we have to treat it differently. I would also say that I don't think this is going to deter drug dealers. And the drugs are coming from China and Mexico. They're not coming from those drug dealers. So I don't think, you know, trying to cut off that source, I don't think that's going to work. I think people are addicted and we have a huge crisis. And unless we try to figure out how to deal with loneliness and chronic pain and all of the things that people are dealing with compassion, we're not going to get to the bottom of the opioid crisis.
We want to hear from you. Give us a call, 549-2937. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or reach out on social media. We're going to move on now to a high-profile case out of southern Georgia. So on Tuesday of this week, a judge denied a request to dismiss misconduct charges against Jackie Johnson. She is the former Glenn County District Attorney who was initially involved in the Ahmaud Arbery case. She's accused of impeding the investigation into his death, and that case has been kind of slow rolling. Renata DiGregorio, you covered the Ahmaud Arbery trial extensively. You were kind of embedded up there in Brunswick for a long time. You were at the initial criminal trial and the federal hate crimes trial. So what were you hearing from family and supporters at that time about former District Attorney Jackie Johnson, a separate case than what was being tried?
Yeah, it is a separate case, but it has always been an issue. From the very beginning, Ahmaud Arbery's family had been saying, you know, this is a piece. It's not going to be done until we fully get justice with what's going on with Jackie Johnson. And it has been, like you said, really slow rolling. I mean, she was indicted in 2021. Her last court date was last December, and even that was delayed as well. So it's been a while, because Ahmaud Arbery's case was wrapped up with the three men who are actually accused in his death. But then the Jackie Johnson is kind of a separate thing. And the judge ended up denying this. The attorney saying right now, her attorney, that there's not evidence for her to still be charged here. Whereas she, of course, is saying, like, no, I recuse myself from this case. It's all right. But it's still going to be happening. It could take even longer, because I believe her attorney is right now in the middle of a really big case in Atlanta. So Ahmaud Arbery's family could still be waiting even longer.
And remind us, Renata, a little bit about what was involved in why she was being charged. I think it was her former investigator, Greg McMichael, mm-hmm. Who was, you know, obviously one of the people ultimately convicted of hate crimes and murder in this case. But it was her relationship with him that created the initial problem.
Yeah, so Jackie Johnson was the top prosecutor, the district attorney, and the first thing, I think, which was the most evident, is that 2 months before, it took 2 months after Ahmaud Arbery was killed to make an arrest, and it was after the video came out. But Greg McMichael was the father of the man who actually pulled the trigger. And after the shooting, one of the pieces of evidence that they're saying is a piece of evidence is that there were 16 calls between Jackie Johnson and Greg McMichael, and he had used to work under her. And so they're saying that she was trying to protect him and she didn't go ahead and make an arrest fast enough.
Randy DeFore, just briefly, why do you think this case might be taking so long?
Well, I think they're slow walking it, but Jackie Johnson had a history of recusing herself but still having some piece of the action in the underlying case, which is a complete violation and a conflict of interest, and violated her oath of office. So she had one in 2020 with the Sasser case. She also talked, before she recused herself, she talked to the neighboring DA and district attorney, and they talked, you know, for a tremendous amount. And he ended up at that time not charging Greg and his son. So I think there's a lot of evidence of impropriety. And I think it will ultimately be taken up. That's why it wasn't dismissed. And I think they'll find her guilty.
And Hethel, obviously a case that the community's taken a great deal of interest in because it was initially seen as helping to cover up this crime. And probably a strong sense on the part of the criminal justice system up there that they do have to address this.
Absolutely, because when she found out that he didn't have the training needed for the job, instead of firing him, she put him on desk duty. And her reasoning was, you know, his wife was going through some health issues and things like that. So there's already some evidence there of, you know, where she should have taken the appropriate action as a leader in the community to do the right thing, and that he shouldn't have even been in that position to begin with. I think accountability is really important, not only when we're talking about the people responsible, but we're talking about systematic racism in America and how do all parts, whether it's the government, whether it's law enforcement, play a role in that. And if we're going to do that, we have to hold not only the people that are responsible for doing the shooting accountable, but anybody that may have allowed this crime, nobody would have known about it.
Well, I have used up our time, so there is going to be no lightning round today. I apologize for that. But thank you so much to my guests, Renata DiGregorio, Andrew Pantazzi, Randy DeFore, Hethel Bahat. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with the JME Songwriting School.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Serious injury cases are complex, and civil trial attorneys present the evidence juries need to see and hear. More at waynehogan.law.
It's our monthly medical roundtable. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Join me tomorrow at 4 for What's Health Got to Do with It, only on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
In Vermont, a hate crime.
They went to school together in Ramallah. They're best friends from growing up.
In Washington, a plea to act against a spike in anti-Semitism.
A 5-alarm fire that must be extinguished.
Also, the dates are set for next year's televised presidential debates, but will they ever happen? Much more on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Hurley Winkler, a contributor with the Jacksonville Music Experience, recently sat down with singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Rick Ellis to discuss his new single that dropped today. The following is a segment from the Songwriting School interview that can be found on the JME page. Take a listen.
Singer-songwriter Rick Collado, better known as Rick Ellis, has a new album coming out in March. His first single from that album is out now. It's called New York.
So you're leaving New York. I can't help but be a little sad. Looking back at all the times we had in this sleepless town.
The song may sound like it's about New York City, but in a lot of ways, Rick Ellis really wrote it about his hometown, Jacksonville, Florida. Welcome to Jacksonville Music Experience's Songwriting School, where we talk to local songwriters about how they wrote one song. I'm Hurley Winkler. Here's my conversation with Rick Ellis. It seems like you've been writing more songs on piano than guitar in recent years. What feels different about writing a song on the piano?
I think I've always been like more attracted to the piano. When I look at a keyboard, it's just easier to play with different harmonic and melodic structures, I think.
Mm-hmm. You've been making music in Jacksonville and about Jacksonville for many decades now, but this song is about New York City. Why did you decide to focus on New York for this first single?
Well, the song is kind of born, in Jacksonville, because it's about a friend of mine who moved to New York City in 99, like right when we graduated high school, because we went to high school together and we were like pretty good friends in high school, but not like homies, not very close. And so he moved up to New York, and then when I started doing touring, I would go up there and see him, and I was kind of like this link back to Jacksonville. And then over the years, we became very close because I'd see him at least once a year, and it would be this kind of, day of reminiscing and connecting and, catching up and all this stuff. So I was like kind of this Jacksonville diplomat or something. Bushwookie and the hot dog man, feet hanging out of a midtown closet, lovesick and hungover as I've ever been. Breakfast at Tina's for lunch. He's like tied to why I have a relationship with that city, because you could go to New York or any city and just like go, oh, cool, there's a building, or, there's Times Square or whatever. But you don't really get a sense of it, you know what I mean? Yeah, when he left, I was like kind of crushed a little bit. And I know it was emotional for him too, because he had spent more time in New York than he did here. So it's tied to Jacksonville, but it's also about falling in love with a different city.
I think any Billy Joel fan is bound to hear parallels between this song and a song like New York State of Mind, for instance. I know you're a William Joel fan yourself. How much influence did you take from his lyrics and piano style for this song?
Oh, tons. I feel like that's what I was trying to create, or mimic, if anything, or pull from and be inspired by. If I put on Just the Way You Are, it just sounds like that dreamy New York that I have in my head. Don't go changing to try and please me. Yeah, I pulled a lot from Billy Joel, and his use of melody and chord structure has, I think always been attractive to me. Even since I was a kid, I can remember being 3 or 4, when MTV just started, and I used to love that song, Uptown Girl. I could see that line of kind of influence go with me this whole time up to now, 40 years later. Now you're going away.
You recorded this song up in Athens, Georgia with David Barbie, who's well known for producing the Drive-By Truckers, among many other impressive acts. Were there any decisions you and Dave made in the studio that surprised you? Maybe something you hadn't thought of while you were writing the song on your own?
We kind of got to it pretty quick. The other guys that played in the band, they heard demos of the songs, but we had never really played it, So the way the recording session went was we'd start playing a song, and if we got a good take, we'd go to the next song. By the time we got to New York, it was all right, let's try a take. And we did a take, we'd do another take, and then we're like, that seems close. And, they just kind of came up with stuff on the fly. The drummer is not a jazz drummer, and he says, I think that's the most jazzy, don't tell anybody, but I think that's the jazziest I've ever played. He's kind of a four on the floor, just straight up rock drummer. Just how fast we were able to get to it was surprising, And then once we all started talking about the song and ooh, what could we add? The instrumental parts where the melody comes in, the blah, nah, 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 nah. It was really easy for us to be well, let's just add all this stuff and make it real atmospheric. And I was giving them images, think of New York, sun's going down, a train coming around the corner. You're waiting, and everything's just beautiful, and all the trash and everything is beautiful, So we all kind of had the same vision.
New York is the first single you're releasing from your new album, which is titled These Things Happen. What was it about this song that made you decide it should be the one to give a first impression of the album?
kind of because of how different it is compared to what I've done before. I like that it's slow. Like, usually the first single would be something real, you know, upbeat and catchy is kind of what you'd want to go for. But heartfelt is what I'm going for now, and lush and cinematic.
Every night felt like a movie, but all the extras are stars in this town.
The new Rickolas album, These Things Happen, will be here in March. For local music updates, head on over to jacksmusic.org.
That's our program. Join us again Monday when we talk with parents and former students about how the Duval School District handles teacher complaints. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.